It is nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 31 degrees under partly, perhaps even mostly cloudy skies. Out at the airport, they are showing wind speeds variable at 3 miles per hour, and they have a full 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for isolated snow showers. Otherwise, partly sunny skies this afternoon with a high near 30, northwest winds to 10. For tonight, a slight chance of snow followed by a high likelihood of rain and snow after midnight. Coming up on the Midday Report, reactions from Trident Seafood's announcement that it will be selling its Kodiak processing plant. Gaps in law enforcement response have been noted in cases of missing and murdered Native people, especially here in Alaska. And Kisilov lanterns, too, have recently been returned by the Smithsonian Institution. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Actor Jonathan Majors has been found guilty on two counts of assaulting and harassing a former girlfriend in New York. But a jury found Majors not guilty of intentional assault and aggravated harassment. NPR's Anastasia Siulkas has more from the courthouse.
A six-person jury convicted Jonathan Majors of assaulting and harassing a former girlfriend, Grace Jabari, in Manhattan in March. The two had argued after Jabari saw a text on Majors' phone from another woman. Police found Jabari with cuts, bruises, and a broken finger. Before the trial, Majors was a fast-rising Hollywood star. He was recently cast as Kang the Conqueror in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and Majors had already appeared in the film Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, as well as on the most recent season of Loki on Disney+. Disney had planned for him to lead a Kang-centered film in 2026, but it's not clear if that film will move ahead. Majors will be sentenced on February 6th. Anastasia Tsoulikas, NPR News, New York.
Additional aid for Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pacific is almost certainly delayed until next year. Hamstrung by differences on immigration policy as record numbers of migrants arrive at the U.S. border with Mexico, here's NPR's Eric McDaniel.
It's all one big bill, foreign aid and immigration policy reform meant to tackle U.S. national security and humanitarian concerns. But while there is some semblance of agreement on aid, immigration reform has daunted lawmakers for decades, and it continued to do so in intensive negotiations over the weekend. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who oversees Customs and Border Protection, represented the Biden administration in long meetings with Senate negotiators. With the House already home for the holidays and unlikely to return, no bill text, and lingering policy differences, it now seems all but certain that if there is a deal to be had, it would come next year. Eric McDaniel, NPR News, Washington.
Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is the latest high-ranking U.S. official to visit Israel. Washington's been urging Israel to scale down its major combat operations in Gaza. But in Tel Aviv today, Austin also expressed solidarity with Israel's war against militants following Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel.
And I know that Israel has been profoundly changed from where you were on October 6th. So I'm here with a clear message. America's support for Israel's security is unshakable. And Israel is not alone.
Meanwhile, the foreign minister of France has announced an additional 700 tons of humanitarian aid for Gaza civilians in the coming days. U.S. stocks end the day higher with the Dow closing up. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Trident Seafoods announced it's selling its year-round processing plant in Kodiak last week. The company has had a major presence on the island for years, and as KMXT's Brian Venwa reports, community leaders and fishermen alike are concerned about how this will impact the archipelago's economy.
Jerry Cobbin Kanagan and her family fished for Trident on and off for decades. She says the announcement was a huge shock for just about everyone she knows.
Speaking with management, there wasn't any heads up for anyone, and they decided, according to management, that they wanted full transparency so that the fleet would know they don't have any buyers yet, but they wanted to put it out that everything is for sale.
The archipelago's Tanner crab season starts next month, but Kanagan says she's dismayed that there seems to be little commitment for upcoming fishing seasons.
They will be buying Tanners, and they will be buying for the A season of pollock. They cannot expand on anything else past that. So we are salmon fishermen, and they cannot guarantee that they will be available for us to buy our salmon.
A spokesperson for Trident declined to verify if they will be buying the species Kanagan cited and refused to comment further on the situation, only saying they're focused on supporting their employees, fishermen, and partners at this time. In a press release earlier this week, Trident wrote it would operate, quote, a significantly scaled-back winter season in Kodiak, but did not provide any more information. Trident has a huge imprint in Kodiak. The processing plant is one of the biggest buildings in the city's downtown and has been part of the community for half a century. Kanagan says Trident leaving the island paints a bleak picture for the seafood industry as a whole, and that a lot of people have questions on what it means for other processors in town.
I think it's troubling for every one of us in Kodiak.
Pat Branson is the city of Kodiak's mayor. She says city officials didn't have any kind of advance notice that the processor would sell the Kodiak facility either. She says she met with Trident staff on Tuesday when the announcement went public, but didn't get any more information than was on the press release. Branson also shared concerns for the Kodiak plant staff and the families affected, especially going into the holiday season.
It's going to affect everyone, whether you're involved in the fishing business or not, because that's what our economic engine is here. So having a major player in our community like Trident putting their business up for sale is really a concern for all of us.
She says all the city can hope for now is that Trident will be transparent as potential sales move forward. Kanagan says she wanted to continue fishing for Trident, but now that the plant she lives near is being sold, she has a lot of questions about job security.
So it raises a tremendous amount of uncertainty in our minds right now of whether or not we will have a market. The other processing plant have full fleet, so where does that leave the 45 boats that fish for Trident out of Kodiak? Where do we go? What do we do?
It's currently unknown if Trident has any potential buyers for the Kodiak processing plant or any of its other plants listed for sale. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venwa.
A recent report to Congress on gaps in law enforcement response to cases of missing and murdered Native people had a special chapter just on Alaska. KUAC's Robin reports.
The report was written as a response to the Not Invisible Act, passed by Congress in 2019. The commission set up, as part of the legislation, tracked and reported data on missing and murdered Indigenous people and human trafficking cases. It investigated the poor response of some law enforcement and legal agencies around the country and tried to find out why.
We deserve the same level of attention and resources to address the issues within our communities.
That's tribal judge and attorney Michelle Demert. She's a University of Alaska Fairbanks professor and sat on the commission. She said as the group began its research, they began to understand the law enforcement and legal problems unique to Alaska.
I tell you, in these meetings with tribes from all over the nation, everyone who had their first experience with Alaska Native issues were so outraged.
The commission held several hearings across the country. One in Alaska was last April. Demert says the disproportionate rates of violence toward Native women, men, and children, including domestic violence, sexual violence, trafficking, kidnapping, and murder, stem from our legal history, starting with statehood and Public Law 280.
So Alaska became a state. The federal government said, well, we're going to give you, state of Alaska, all of our jurisdiction that we have over Indian tribes for civil and criminal jurisdiction, but we're not going to give you any money.
Alaska is one of six PL-280 states where law enforcement and justice of tribes is managed by the state government rather than the federal government.
But if you're in a non-PL-280 state, we have money for those tribes that we have shared jurisdiction with. That's a huge difference. That's a huge disparity.
The commission also noted Alaska's novel history through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act that set up for-profit regional corporations instead of reservations like in the Lower 48. So they made several recommendations in the Alaska-specific chapter, such as getting the federal departments of justice and interior to look at each of Alaska's 226 tribes and assess law enforcement, courts, and related government services for every one of them.
I'm hoping that Congress will set some hearings in the Senate and the House to address the recommendations and see what can actually be furthered.
Demert says grassroots activism by Alaska Native organizations and the families of victims is helping educate law enforcement agencies.
But I think there has been a cultural change. The more awareness and ideas, the better the public response can be.
But she says Alaska needs to have several grand changes in order to have villages become as safe as they could be.
Tribal police would be the best investment, I believe, because you have people who are from the community, who want to see it heal, who want to see safe, happy families living peacefully and safely.
Congress has 90 days to respond to the report, which was released November 1st.
This is not just for a moment in time, but this report needs to transcend administrations as well as Congress sessions.
In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Landslides are almost impossible to forecast precisely, but scientists say more data could help. Southeast Alaska mostly lacks the kind of monitoring that could make people safer. But at the site of last month's deadly Wrangell slide, the Alaska Department of Transportation has begun the installation of new weather stations and a survey of the island's elevation, as KTOO's Anna Canny reports.
The Wrangell landslide happened in an instant. Somewhere high on a slope above Zamovia Highway, the earth shifted, and that triggered a river of mud that fanned out and ran down the hill for nearly 4,000 feet, crossing the beach and spilling into the ocean. People living on the hillside had little warning, just the sound of the slide coming their way. It buried two houses, leaving five people dead, and one still missing. According to state geologist Barrett Salisbury with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, it's extremely challenging to detect disasters like this before they happen.
We're always going to be surprised by a landslide event. We could give you an estimate of where we think the hot spots for future activity could be, would be. But there's no guarantee, and it's pretty unlikely that we would get all those spot on.
One thing is guaranteed. Across the steep mountain slopes of southeast Alaska, those hot spots are everywhere. And human-caused climate change could trigger even more slides in the future. Landslides are incredibly complex. Each one is shaped by the unique geology, hydrology, and vegetation on a given slope. That's the biggest reason why they're so hard to predict. But scientists like state geologist Gabriel Wolken say that Southeast also severely lacks the kinds of monitoring that could make people safer.
We have, you know, this broad understanding of the different ingredients that come into play to aid the development of a landslide, but we still lack data.
The ingredients are the basic when and where of slides. The when is most often shaped by heavy rain. All the deadly slides over the last decade, in Wrangell, Haines, and Sitka, all happened during strong rainstorms. On steep terrain, the earth is always resisting the pull of gravity. If there's enough rainfall all at once, the soil can become saturated, and the solid earth transforms into a heavy slurry of water, mud, and other debris.
Trees, shrubs, homes, cars, anything in the way becomes a part of this debris flow.
It's incredibly difficult to figure out a threshold where there's enough rain to create landslide conditions, and the scarcity of weather stations makes it impossible. For most Southeast communities, the most complete and official weather data is collected at airports, which are on flat ground close to sea level. but the mix of ocean and steep mountains in the region causes weather to behave very differently across even small distances.
It could have been a cloud literally was denser 10 miles away from town and it rained more, or high winds were focused because of the shape of the mountains and the channels there to trigger that landslide, but we don't know.
To remedy this problem, the Alaska Department of Transportation will install two new weather stations in Wrangell, one at the base of the slope and one near the ridge. That data may help scientists narrow down the when, at least. The where is much harder, but Wolken says history is a good rule of thumb.
There is this repetition on the landscape where one landslide has occurred in the past. There is then the possibility that landslides tend to occur in the same places.
Residents across Wrangell Island have stories of smaller slides that have left piles of dirt in their own backyards. More overgrown slide scars can be spotted from planes or boats. And the November slide created new hotspots, including several smaller slides that broke off from the main path and stopped just short of houses. All of those paths are prone to slide again. Aerial surveys of Wrangell Island from before and after the November storm will be used to build models of the island's elevation. Scientists can use those models to find potentially unstable slopes. Wolken says that's a good starting place, and working to collect more data on landslide conditions is especially important as warming driven by the burning of fossil fuels makes Southeast even more slide prone.
Particularly with increases in heavy rain, snowfall, and rapid temperature changes, and in particular intense precipitation as we've seen be linked to some of these landslides.
Scientists will never be able to pinpoint the next disaster, but after the deadly 2015 slide in Sitka, researchers started to develop a risk-based warning system, founded in large part on rainfall data and records of past slides. Many Southeast communities, like Wrangell, are looking to that as an example of how they could monitor their slopes in the future. The effort to collect more data is just a small step in that direction. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
Support for KMXT comes from Alaska's most advanced network. GCI's resilient and redundant network is keeping schools connected across the state. Details at gci.com/education.
And we have breaking news today. The Kodiak Island Borough School District received a bomb threat today, according to an email to parents from the superintendent's office sent late this morning. The superintendent wrote in the email that it's not believed to be a credible threat, but sent staff home for the rest of the day in an abundance of caution. Classes are on winter break. The district is currently working with law enforcement and plans to resume normal operations tomorrow morning. This is a developing story. Tune in to the KMXT Evening Report at 5 for more. Nancy Dahlstrom's campaign for a U.S. House now has a powerful backer in Washington, D.C., the Speaker of the House. Grow the Majority, a fundraising committee affiliated with Speaker Mike Johnson, filed documents allowing it to raise funds for Dahlstrom, a Republican and currently Alaska's lieutenant governor. Republican campaign consultant Art Hackney says the move is significant and suggests the national GOP money will focus on Dahlstrom and not the other Republican in the race, Nick Begich.
She's just a pretty solid, straightforward, hard-working person, so she obviously impressed the living daylights out of them.
Dahlstrom announced last month that she is vying to unseat Democratic incumbent Mary Peltola from the lower chamber of Congress. Her campaign did not respond to emails seeking an interview for this story, nor did Begich. Flipping the Alaska seat is a top target of the National Republican Congressional Committee. The small Kasiloff Historical Museum recently acquired two maritime navigation lanterns from the Smithsonian Institution. The oil-burning beacons operated on the shore of Cook Inlet for over 30 years, aiding navigation into the Kasiloff River. KDLL's Hunter Morrison spoke with Historical Association members about the acquisition and its value locally. KDLL's Hunter Morrison spoke with Historical Association members about the acquisition and its value locally.
Before the days of a reliable road system, much of the Kenai Peninsula could only be accessed via boat. A popular but challenging entry point from Cook Inlet is the Kasiloff River, which has been used by mariners since the construction of the peninsula's first salmon cannery in the late 1800s. With an increase in vessel traffic, the Coast Guard added two navigational beacons in the form of kerosene lanterns near the mouth of the river in 1929. Light from the 2-foot-tall lanterns could be seen up to 5 miles away. They operated seasonally and were maintained by local citizen lamp lighters until they were replaced by electric beacons in 1962. They are believed to be the last oil-burning lanterns used for navigational purposes on the American coast.
The river channel is pretty squirrely because Cook Inlet is has so much sediment and it has such huge tides that there's no direct line from offshore into the mouth of the river.
That's Catherine Cassidy, secretary of the Kasiloff Regional Historical Association.
Even today on charts, they say, you know, local knowledge is very important for navigating into the river.
After the lanterns were retired, the Coast Guard offered them to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Kasiloff Regional Historical Association President Brent Johnson orchestrated bringing the artifacts back home. He suspects they were never put on display at the Institute.
I thought, I'll bet you they're sitting in a back room that nobody ever looks at the Smithsonian when they could be here in our museum where they belong.
Johnson, who now sits on the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly and serves as its president, says he remembers seeing the lanterns in use while duck hunting as a child. Cassie says she was unaware of the existence of the lanterns and was doubtful they could be located at the Smithsonian.
They not only could locate them in their storage right away, but eventually they said they would be happy to have these lanterns back in Kasiloff where they are meaningful to people, and they were really delighted to give them to us. So cool.
The Kasiloff Historical Museum acquired the kerosene lanterns this fall and is working to create a display for the artifacts. Historical Association members believe these lanterns are a symbol of the peninsula's maritime history that is still relevant today.
This is old history, sort of encapsulated in these lanterns, but it's an ongoing part of our community to have access to this river.
History changes. One thing is super important at one point in history, and it becomes less important at another point.
Again, Brent Johnson.
I think those navigation lights are still important because people are still using the Kasiloff River.
The Kasiloff Historical Museum is located on K Beach Road in Kasiloff, a half mile north of the Sterling Highway. The museum is open 1 to 4 p.m. every day, Memorial Day through Labor Day. You can view the lanterns beginning this summer. In Kasiloff, I'm Hunter Morrison.
A Japanese steelmaker wants to buy U.S. steel. I'm Nobusafo with the Marketplace Minute. The deal announced today is valued at $15 billion. If regulators approve, Japan's Nippon Steel will own the storied American company, giving it a big share of the U.S. market for steel used for long-lasting products such as vehicles and solar panel components. Some shippers are opting for a longer way between the Red Sea and the West after a series of missile and armed drone attacks along a gateway to the sea. Yemen's Houthi rebels are taking responsibility, claiming solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. U.S. safety regulators are probing a series of reported engine failures in Nissan vehicles. The preliminary investigation includes the popular Rogue SUV. I'm Nobusafo with a Marketplace Minute.
Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 18th day of December, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 9:50. It will set again promptly at 4:22 this afternoon, giving us 6 hours and 32 minutes of daylight, a loss of mere 34 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high for this date was 48 degrees set in 1984, and our record low is -2, set in 1997. It is currently 31 degrees in Kodiak under partly cloudy skies, maybe mostly cloudy, with some breaks. At the airport, they are still showing variable winds at 3 miles per hour and 10 full miles of visibility. This afternoon, look for isolated snow showers until 1 or so. Otherwise, partly sunny skies are predicted today, with a high near 30, northwest winds to 10. For tonight, a chance of snow before 1 a.m., then a high likelihood of rain and snow between 1 and 4 a.m., and snow is highly likely after 4 a.m. tonight. Mostly cloudy overnight, with a low around 24. Light and variable winds are expected to turn to the southeast in the evening, could gust as high as 20. For tomorrow, look for snow until 10 in the morning, followed by rain and snow showers until 1 p.m., and a slight chance of rain showers after that. High near 36 tomorrow with southeast winds, rather, to 25 miles per hour, coming down to 10 or 15 later in the afternoon, but could gust as high as 35 tomorrow. Looking at our local tides, we just had a low tide, and it is low tide on the west side. Your low tide will happen in about 30 seconds at 12:26 p.m. and be 4.6 feet. Our low tide here on the west side happened at 11:42 this morning. It was a 3-foot tide. Our next high tide here on the west side will happen at 5:39 this afternoon, be 8 feet. Over in Larson Bay, your high tide will happen at 6:12 p.m. and be 12.5 feet tonight. Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Gale warning for tomorrow. North 20 becoming southeast 20 tonight. Seas to 6 feet today and tonight. For tomorrow, southeast 30 becoming west 35 in the afternoon. That should be nice and sloppy. Seas to 10 feet. And for Tuesday night, southwest 25 and seas to 11 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory for tomorrow. West winds to 20 knots, becoming variable 10 today, seas to 4 feet. East 10 tonight, increasing to 20 after midnight, seas 2 feet, building to 4 feet after midnight tonight on our west side. And for tomorrow in the Shelikof, east winds to 25 knots, becoming west 20 in the afternoon, 5-foot seas, with freezing spray in the Shelikof after midnight tomorrow. The following are upcoming Kodiak Island Borough public meetings.
On Tuesday, December 19th at 6 o'clock, Fire Protection Area Number 1 Board is having a work session at the Bayside Fire Hall. On Wednesday, December 20th at 5:15, the Solid Waste Advisory Board is having a regular meeting at the Kodiak Fisheries Research Center Conference Room. Also Wednesday on December 20th at 6:30, the Planning and Zoning Commission is having a regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers. And on Thursday, December 21st, the Borough Assembly is having a regular meeting at 6:30 p.m. in the Borough Assembly Chambers.
All these meetings are open to the public, and the meeting packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 for any questions. The Kodiak Audubon Society is inviting all bird watchers to participate in the longest-running community science survey, the annual Audubon Christmas Bird Count, on December 17th. The annual Audubon Christmas Bird Count for the... December 17th for the in-town count and December 30th for the Chiniac Narrow Cape count. Birders and nature enthusiasts will participate in this tradition, many rising before dawn and staying out until dusk. Birders of all ages and abilities are welcome to contribute to this fun nationwide community science project. The compiler arranges volunteers into small parties who follow assigned routes, counting every bird they see. Some people also watch feeders instead of following routes. Interested field birders and feeder watchers must arrange with the count compiler in advance to participate. To sign up for the in-town count, that's Sunday, December 17th, contact Bill Pyle at 907-942-1410. To sign up for the Narrow Cape Chiniac count, that's Saturday, December 30th, contact Robin Corcoran at 907-654-0997. And again, that happens the 17th for in-town and on the 30th for Chiniac and Narrow Cape. Well, you're all invited to KMXT's holiday party. That's happening tomorrow Tuesday, at 6:30 p.m. Celebrate the season with us and enjoy some refreshments and the White Elephant gift exchange. It's all happening right here at the station at 620 Egan Way in between the high school and the library. That's happening December 19th, tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. It's always a lot of fun, and you are definitely invited. The Angels of Love program is continuing through January 13th. Place your loved one's name on an angel for display on the hospital holiday trees that are displayed in the Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center. Honor the life of someone you miss or celebrate the life of someone you admire. It's a $10 donation for each angel, and you can make your donation at the hospital admitting or specialty clinic reception desks or pay online at www.kodiakhospitalauxiliary.org, and they have a handy donate button. Caregivers of Kodiak's youngest community members are invited to the Diaper Distribution Center for free diapers and wipes on the fourth Friday of each month. That's coming up on Friday, December 22nd, this Friday. That happens from 4 to 7 p.m. at 1910 East Razanov, the Diaper Distribution Center. It's a ministry of the Frontier Southern Baptist Church. Diapers are available in all sizes on a first-come, first-served basis while supplies last, and size swaps are welcome. Bring out grown diapers in good condition and trade them in for your baby's current size. Again, that's at 1910 East Razanov, and that's happening Friday, 4 to 7 p.m.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT two times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.